And what we're doing here now is we got last time to chapter 3, verse 8. Chapter 3, verse 8. And this really is its own little political world. And I think it's very, very important to understand. Just one moment. Give me one second here for someone that's... trying to come in. Let's do that. Okay, so it's very important to understand here what's going on. I'd like to start off with a quote from Esther Rubber. Esther Rubber, which is actually in Parsha Zion, which is section 7. And it says the famous adage, and that's that every Rosha that comes up in the world thinks he's a clever, better Rosha than the previous ones. And Haman was no exception. And he thought to himself, gosh, that Paroi in Egypt, what a fool that man was. What an absolute idiot Pharaoh was of ancient Egypt. I don't know who that Pharaoh was. Maybe he was Akhenaten the second. I don't know. But, certain historical things would say he's Akhenaten. But either which way, what an idiot that Paro was. What did we say at the Haggadah? We said that Paro envisaged the Jewish Mashiach would be a boy. So we'll throw all boys into the Nile to be ate by the crocodiles. And we'll leave all the girls, all the Jewish girls, will be available for Egyptian men, most desirable. Said Haman, what an idiot that Paro was. Doesn't he realize that if those Jewish girls marry Egyptian men, which was Paro's initial idea to have a glut of women available, all the children born to that union will also be Jews, and you'll be building the next resurgence of Jewry into the world. You can't have that. Basically, you're not really getting rid of the problem. You're just kind of putting a band-aid on the problem now, but you're sweeping dust under the carpet and eventually it's going to make a bump you're going to trip up over. The only way to deal with the Jews is to annihilate them. So he felt as if Paro's plan of getting rid of the Jewish boys was half-baked. And had he been as clever as Haman was, he'd have got rid of them all when he had the chance. That's the Medrash Rabbah on Esther, Parsha Zion. And what's going on? Why does it say that about this Pasuk pair? Pasuk 8 in chapter 3 is the manual for any neo-Nazi group that may be listening in tonight. If, I don't know, for whatever reason this gets into the hands of some neo-Nazi group, they would do well to listen to these Pasukim and figure out exactly how the Holocaust was planned, but they should also figure out how it was foiled as well. Let's look at verse 8. Verse 8 is Haman selling the idea of Holocaust to his superior. What's his pitch? How's he going to sell this dastardly deed through to the highest echelons of society? How's he going to pass this law? Let's have a look. Verse 8. So this is the implementation of the final solution, and he wants justification. Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is one particular people dispersed and detached among the peoples throughout all of your kingdoms and provinces. Their laws differ from all those other people, and they don't obey the king's laws. Therefore, it doesn't pay for the king to tolerate them. Now, up until this particular idea, no one had thought about wiping out an entire nation, obliterating it for no good reason. They weren't a threat. They were just unlikable. Now, notice the way that Haman is couching his argument is to a man who isn't against the plan per se, but he does find it politically most unsavory to do so for various reasons. Now, Chazal have listed five separate concerns that Ahasuerus had to go through with Haman's plan. And we will see that in this one pasuk, in verse 8, Haman has addressed all five concerns that Ahasuerus had. So I think this pasuk was written with great divine inspiration that was essentially a digest of tremendous amounts of political discussion that happened before this was committed to writing. So let's see what the problems are and how this is going to pan out. So it says Chazal, and the Al-Shech HaKadosh lists these five, but Chazal bring them down as well. Haman had five separate political reasons not to go along with Haman's plan. So Ahasuerus could have said, look, I like the idea in principle, but what about this, what about this, what about this, what about this, etc. This is the first problem that he envisaged, Ahasuerus. What about the potential for civil uprising or strife? Said Ahasuerus, the Jews may have associated with or intermarried with other nations. And the allies that once they married into other people, they would come to the aid of the Jews and they'd fight against the royal army and essentially would have a civil war or mass civil unrests and riots, which I'll have to go and quell, which frankly nobody wants. It's not good for a peaceful kingdom and it can lead to worse things down the line. So that's one big problem as to why I don't want to go ahead with this plan. Big problem number two. The Jews, as we know, can be very tenacious warriors. And we don't need the hassle of quelling the Jews in the uprising in the ghettos or the Shvatim. We know the Shvatim could have destroyed Egypt when Yehuda turned round to all the brothers and said, you take a street each and we'll rip Egypt apart. They're a problem. When the Jews become strong, they're a problem for the whole world. Everyone's worried. After the Six-Day War, it was Russia that called Israel and said, you'd better not go any further north in Lebanon. You know, yes, you've taken Beirut, yeah, but if you keep pushing further north, it affects our interests and we're going to have to come and get involved. So just stop already. I.e. the other nations of the world are worried when Israel goes on the warpath. So he was worried that they'd stand up and make a very strong defence and make terrible casualties among the king's own soldiers and people. And it will be to a whole mess politically, time-wise. And it becomes so long, such a long protracted war, nobody needs it. So that's another reason I don't want to do it. Okay. Reason number three, bizarrely, is environmental concerns from logistical perspectives. If I destroy all the Jews, one area of the land in the kingdom might become desolate. And the problem is if I've got no people in that particular land, that land's not looked after. The roads aren't maintained. The forests aren't maintained. The place will become overgrown. And when I want to move my armies or my admin or my maritime things through that, there's going to be a whole slew of problems of broken roads and landslides and all these problems that the people of that place wouldn't have fixed. So essentially it's going to cause like a deserted region when I wipe out these people. And I don't want to do that because I don't like the logistical mess. That's a third reason that Ahasuerus gave as to why he did not want to go along with his plan. Reason number four. It might cause other nations to become disloyal because they're scared they'd hit the same fate. If Ahasuerus doesn't like you, he kills you all. In which case, nobody likes me anymore and I lose my popularity. And that's politically very bad news. He was worried of maybe acting savagely and destroying one of his own people that depend upon him, despite the fact there's no overt crime at all, apart from being unlikable. And therefore, other people thought maybe, you know what? If he doesn't like us, he's going to do the same. Let's revolt and let's forget this king. He's useless. He doesn't need that. No king needs that. No emperor needs that. And lastly, there's the fiscal loss here. There's a fiscal impact in killing all the Jews, because if you kill all the Jews, you are very likely to make a large financial loss. So let's recap the five reasons Ahasuerus didn't like the idea of Haman's plan. They are number one, potential for civil unrest. Number two, the Jews can be tenacious warriors in and of themselves. And essentially I've got, you know, a little war that I need to sort, which who needs that? It's expensive, it's bloody, it's difficult, it's politically unsavoury. I've got environmental concerns. As much as you don't like them, the people in any particular area maintain that particular area, which is useful for me. And that saves me a fortune. Number four, I might get disloyalty from other nations that might fear that I'll treat them the way that I'm treating the Jews, and lead to all kinds of political and civil issues within the actual monarchy and kingdom, which means when I issue edicts, nobody will listen to me. And lastly, number five, I'm going to lose a lot of money. I'm going to lose a lot of money. The Jews are wealthy and they're successful, and I tax them heavily. And, you know, they're important to me. They're important to me as a leverage monetarily. So when you add all five of those together, that makes a most compelling argument as to why this plan of genocide against the Jews shouldn't go through, despite your hatred of them and their general dislike, because of overwhelming factors that would seem to make absolutely perfect sense as to just shelve this plan as, you know, a bizarre plan that we don't need to talk about. Haman addressed all these five concerns in one pasuk, pasuk 8. And these are very well thought out, well planned responses by Haman who offset these arguments. Let's look at argument number one. There's a potential for civil uprising because the Jews may have associated with, entered to business with, married into other nations, and those other nations will feel a sense of kin or loyalty to the Jews, and they'll stand up for the Jews and fight with them, and we'll have a real problem on our hands. We'll have riots. Haman said as follows, do not be concerned with people who the Jews have associated with, because you don't need to worry. They don't mix with anybody and they don't intermarry. This is another one of the sources in the Torah, along with Egypt and many others, where we see the Jews in exile don't intermarry. Intermarriage is a scourge, and the Jews are very, very careful to stick amongst their own, because they're one people. They don't mix with anyone else. No one's going to stick up for them. No one likes them. You don't need to worry about that. The other 70 nations, the Ummah Sa'olam, have all intermingled to such an extent that it's a big melting pot. You can't really distinguish. Like if you go to London today, you know, who's really Indian? Who's really Bangladeshi? They're kind of London Bangladeshi. They're kind of London, you know. There's like a new breed of melting pot where you can't really say I'm really Argentinian. Did you know the fifth largest Italian city is London? London is the fifth largest city in the world with an Italian population. That's because so many Italians have migrated to London. So much so, you know, the Green Network Energy, who was my electricity company, was run by Italians for Italians, and their phone lines were in Italian, and you'd have to press a number to hear English. You believe that? So when things change over a few centuries, everyone melts in together, not so the Jews. Not so the Jews. There's no other race or language that can claim to be as uninfluenced by any other race or language as the Jewish people. Indeed, that's why they're used as control groups within genetic monitoring. When you have a genetic test, you always try to use Jews, interestingly, because we know that genetically they keep very much to themselves because they don't intermarry. They're very, very, very careful. Very, very careful about it. So that was what Haman said. That's another reason not to worry about them. This one particular people can call themselves one particular people, and you can single them out, unlike any other group, because they don't mix. So don't think that everyone's going to join to their aid. They're not. They're not. So worry number one that lead to civil unrest with Gentiles coming to the aid of the Jews because they feel a sense of kinsmanship with them. You don't have to worry about it at all. So we can knock that nail on the head. Boom, that's problem one. What was problem number two? The problem number two was the Jews are tenacious warriors and we don't need to have to fight with them now. So what did he say? It's a good question. It's a good Taina Hashrosh, but don't worry. Even if Israel did decide to defend themselves, have no fear, because, and these are his words, they're dispersed throughout all of the kingdom's provinces. They're scattered. They're not an Achdus-like group. They don't all live in one province only. They're all throughout the whole country, all throughout all the provinces. You don't need to worry about it. Some are in one place, some are another. They'll never be able to logistically organize and band themselves together to make a coordinated response. And there's no large concentration of Jews in one particular area where it's going to be a problem. And if you do worry that the Jews will rally together in one city and revolt from there, the Jews are detached. A lot of the groups don't even communicate with each other. He said that. Says that, Chazal say that, that one group of Jews, the Jews of Shushan, weren't necessarily in particularly close relationship with the Jew. Remember, in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, in Rhodesia, before it became Zimbabwe, Rhodesia, there are the Jews of Bulawayo and Harare. Those are the two main Jewish centres that were there, right? But they didn't have much to do with each other. If you're in Harare, you're in Harare. You're in Bulawayo, you're in Bulawayo. You know what I mean? The Jews in Johannesburg don't have so much to do with the Jews in Cape Town. You know what I'm saying? They aren't. You don't have to worry that they're like one unified group across the entire country. They're like pockets of communities everywhere. That's how they're like. So they're not going to be able to band together with any form of cohesive unit. And those pockets are far away, and they're also spread amongst Gentile nations. Their rallying together from such far off places is useless. So you don't need to worry about problem number two, which is the Jews can be tenacious warriors. They're not going to, even if they could be, they're so broken up and factionalized, you don't need to worry about it at all. So one is the goyim aren't going to help them, and two is they're not going to help themselves. Worry number three, environmental concerns. The Jews, you know, they might be looking after roads and thoroughfares or canals or something. And if that like goes to pot, I'll have a problem when I need that logistical network. Says Haman, don't worry about that. There's not going to be any uninhabited region in your kingdom because, as I've already said, the Jews are spread throughout your kingdom. There's no one pocket of Jews that are spread away from the Gentiles. There's only one Jewish province. Don't worry about that. Even if you killed all the Jews everywhere, listen to me, in England, you've got what? London, Manchester, Gateshead. Let's say all the Jews of London, Manchester, Gateshead left. Do you think London, Manchester, Gateshead are going to turn to pot? No, there's a goyim in London, Manchester, Gateshead to keep the place going. Don't need to worry about that. It isn't as if, you know, in Berkshire, there's a 100% Jewish concentration population. That's it. There's nobody else there. And if you get rid of them, Berkshire will go to pot. You don't need to worry about it. They don't have their own territory. That's the Gemara Megillah, Daf Yud Gimel on a base. They don't live by themselves. They live amongst Gentile nations and they have to manage like that. No environmental concerns whatsoever. That's three out of five knocked on the head. What was the next one? You might have disloyalty from other regions. You might have saying, ooh, he doesn't like the Jews, is what he does. Then maybe he won't like, I don't know, the Uyghurs or something like that. And he'll do that to us. Oh, you know what? We'll side with the Jews. When Shechita was looking at being banned in the UK, it's very important that the Muslims sided with the Jews. Because they realised if Shechita's banned, then halal meat is also going to be up for the chop. No pun intended. Yeah? So they all banded together. Oh, Achashverosh is worried about that. One group will join another group because it makes political sense to do that. Haman had to address that problem. You know, he had to address politically, maybe groups will rally together for their own reasons, not because they like the Jews, but because it suits them for their own agenda. So he said their laws differ from all other peoples. He talked specifically about the laws of Sukkos. And he says they decorate their shuls with greenery for Shavuos. That's one of the places we know that there's a minhag to actually have flowers in the shul on Sukkos, because Haman used that as one of the interesting pointers as to how Jews are different from Zoroastrians and other people like that who are around. They're weird. They've got their own laws. And if you saw them, you'd say no one's going to like them. No one's going to hang them out with them. They're completely different. And if you think that the laws of this nation were logical, and ethical and proper, then of course you couldn't blame a nation for choosing its own laws over the kingdom. But their laws are weird. They won't eat certain foods and they won't go to certain places like circuses and theatres. They're weird. You don't have to worry about them. No one's going to side with them, because essentially he put forward the anti-Semitic concept of everybody else hates them as well. Everybody hates the Jews. You know, I mean, I remember when I was growing up, I was taught, you know, why do Jews smell? So the blind people could hate them as well. That was a joke someone told me when I was growing up, yeah? Everybody hates the Jews. You don't have to worry, says Ahasuerus. He said to Ahasuerus, everybody hates them. No one's going to stick up. They'll realize the reason you're after them is because they are intrinsically hated. Nobody likes them. Nobody's going to stick up for them. Nobody's going to rally to their aid. You don't have to worry about them at all. They live differently with their own laws. They're odd. Ignore them. That knocked number four on the head. What was number five? Money. We'll lose Jewish income, which is a problem. Indeed, the Germans made sure to steal all the Jewish property from the Jews, strip them of it in the camps, and then put them on armoured trains going to Switzerland. We need the money. Even if you need to kill them, you need the money. Everyone agrees with that, right? That's a problem. Fiscal implication. So said Haman, again in this pasuk, you don't need to worry about it. It does not pay for the king to tolerate them. Look at the last line. It doesn't pay. I'll tell you why. It's not worthwhile. I know you're worried. What about loss of taxes? But I'm telling you, their practice is to rebel and bring ruin upon kings. Yes, you might make a lot of money with the Jews short term, but long term, Ove, look at Paro. Look at only what happened to Egypt. They made a lot of money out of the Jews. A lot of money. Yosef, he initiated something still today in Egypt. Today in Egypt, according to Egypt law, there's something called the Joseph tax. Look it up. It's the Joseph tax. That's a tax that every member of Egyptian culture has to give the government. That they kept. Paro liked that very much. Because Yosef organized all taxes to the kingdom for exchange of bread. And all the Jews were very, very, very beneficial for Egypt's money. But look what happened in the end, said Haman. They lost it all. They lost all their money and the Jews scooped it up at Yamsuf. Ugh, you know, you think you're getting money now, long term it's a bad investment. Bad investment. And they'll send all their money, which will be your money, to the Holy Land to build their temple, which you don't even want to build. You've already said you don't want to build that. So I'm telling you, long term, I'm saving you money. I'm saving the crown money. You don't want their money. It's bad money. The Jews are rebellious. That's what we do. That's what he said. So with those five arguments are all knocked on the head in Pasuk Ches. Verse 8. As he says, Haman said to the king, there is one particular people, they're separated, you don't need to worry about it. They're dispersed and detached among all the peoples that your king's provinces. Don't need to worry about any civil unrest or any environmental problems. Their laws differ from all the other peoples. No one's going to stick up for them or politically align or rally to them for even their own agendas. They don't obey the king's laws. That means nobody likes them. And it doesn't pay for the king to tolerate them. You think you're going to lose a lot of money. Believe me, I'm saving your fortune. And if you don't think I'm saving your fortune, I'll give you 10,000 talents of silver to compensate you, which is the next pasuk. Let's look at verse 9. If it pleases the king, let an edict be written. Now look at this word, la'abdom. Doesn't mean to destroy. Be very careful with the translation here. La'abdom doesn't mean to destroy. The best translation is really to ruin. La'abdom is to ruin someone. Doesn't mean to physically destroy them. It can mean to ruin them. To ruin their lives. To wash them out. Interesting how he couched this. He's going to change the Loshon in verse 13 to annihilate. So we always learn out when you're passing a political law to do social ethnic cleansing, you always have different Loshon like re-education camps or work camps or re-internment communities, something like that, to very much subtle the blow as to your dastardly plan. You don't say, I want to just, like, you know, kill every Serbian or, you know, Yugoslavian or whatever it is I'm doing. I'm merely putting them to another place where they can work there. La abdom. I'm going to ruin them. And I shall weigh out and pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who perform the work to bring to the king's treasuries. I will enrich the kingdom. Not only will you not lose money, but the actual treasury will gain an absolute fortune. Now, this all looks economic to start with, but there's quite a lot of spiritual undertone in what Haman is saying here. And we need to really examine this, because I think it's very key. I mean, at the Nuremberg trials, when they all got sentenced, they said Purim Fest. Purim Fest. How did they know what Purim was? And why were they so sure that their hanging would be so similar to Purim? It turns out that those people that really hate the Jews, not some a guy in the street that just hates Jews because he doesn't like Jews, but someone who is actively involved in Jewish destruction, tends to be involved in some kind of occultistic, spiritual endeavor where they realize there's things that they have to do in order to be able to destroy this people. And now we have to see how these Roshoim are actually men of very great faith. They've got to believe in quite a lot of Jewish Torah to be able to feel as if they can get through with their plan. Let's see this. Now, Haman was not from, by any stretch of the imagination, but he did have to research what he was doing to destroy Jews. Let's see, fascinatingly, what the Mefarshim say on this pasuk. Haman's original intention was to utterly exterminate every Jewish male, female, and child. Absolute complete wipeout. As we said at the beginning, Paro was a fool. He only got rid of the boys. He didn't get rid of the girls. Should have wiped out everybody. I'll do a better job than him. Okay? But he said la'abdom, which is a very ambiguous expression meaning to ruin or to crush. But he refrained from adding any more explicit words at this stage, just in case the king refuses to comply with his plan, because at the end of the day, Ahasuerus has got to bankroll Haman's plan. He's got to green light this, right? Haman, therefore, chose a far more subtle general phrase in the form of la'abdom, an edict written to destroy, to ruin, to undo the Jews. And that could be interpreted to mean that either the Jews would be deprived of their possessions, which Goyim are only too happy to do. You know, just ask the Cossacks or anyone like that. While they would be kept alive. So what I mean, la'abdom is essentially on their property or their political abilities or influence or the literal meaning that they themselves would perish. It was open. So Haman kept to this very ambiguous language, and he wanted to see what Ahasuerus's facial expression and response would be. How's the king going to react to this plan? Now, if Ahasuerus would interpret Haman's wish as just the financial ruin, Haman would then embellish the text, and he'd change the text to call for utter destruction of the Jews themselves in time. But if he would slowly and gently persuade the king to accept his own view that we should destroy the Jews entirely physically, then he'll get away with it earlier on. But he has to test the waters to see, is Ahasuerus's hatred of the Jews quite on a par with mine? Now, it's interesting, if you have a look at verse 11, which we haven't done yet, the king said, the people, to do with them as you please. I'll give you the people, do with what you want. So what does that mean? It means Ahasuerus, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, Haman. He was not a fool. He was certainly very rash and easy to anger, as we learnt with Vashti. But he chapped what Haman was on about right from the get-go. He said, I see your words are a bit slimy. You know, la'abdom. Yeah, I get you. I get you. I know what that means. I don't have to worry, but don't fear. You don't have to worry about a thing. You can do with these people as you please. Look at verse 11. The king said to Haman, the silver's given to you, and also the people do them as you want. I don't care what you plan with them. You want to kill them? Kill them. It's fine with me. Fine with me. Now, once Haman saw that Ahasuerus so early green-lit the most extreme form of death camp, right from the get-go, he was overjoyed. It was like phenomenal. I don't have to like go around the house. Just, no, do what you want. Really, it's down to you. You've argued your case very well with these five problems. I get it. No problem. Once that means, now look at verse 13. He changes the word la'abdom to la'hashmid. La'hashmid means to physically kill or annihilate. So once he managed to get through the whole la'abdom, and that's, oh, I don't mind, then he can go with a full plan of absolute extermination. So in the beginning, the genocide looked like a rehousing project, moving the Jews to the east, you know, to a better place away from good Germans. But once it was all set in motion, it was an open plan of extermination. Mamish, like history repeats itself, doesn't it? Now, what's going on with these coins of the treasury? Why is he saying, I'll give 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who perform the work to bring to the king's treasury? Why didn't you say, I'll pay you directly? Why did he say, I'll pay the HMRC 10,000 talents of silver? Or the MOD, whoever's actually going to get this done. The HMRC is Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, which is like the IRS. And the MOD is like the Department for Defence in England, which is what's going on here. He's not paying the king personal money. I'll pay the government. And they're going to, I'll do it. I'll bankroll it. You don't have to pay. I'll pay. Hammond says like this. I'll wait out and pay myself 10,000 talents. That's me, he had the money. I'll pay 10,000 talents of silver. Now, the Yalkut Shmoini brings down on this pasuk right here that it says the expression those who perform the work specifically reforms to the is specifically about the coinsmiths, the people who work in the royal mint, who actually press the coins. But why does it say that the silver will be brought to the king's treasuries? It should have just said, let the king be given the silver, and he can do what he wants with it. Like, kill the Jews. Why do you say, I'll give it to the work to the bring to the king's? Well, it's very odd loshen. He says like this. Beautiful, beautiful. Yalkut Shmoni says this. Beautiful idea. There's two types of coins in any country. There's the coins for mass usage by the public that they'll use in the shops. And then there are coins of a very high level quality, which are sterling silver or Karen silver, which essentially are kept and they're not utilized for the public. I'll leave them in the hands of those to perform the work to fashion special coins, and they stay in the king's mint. They stay as a special reserve in the gold reserve of any country. I will enrich the country's gold reserve and silver reserve, the treasury of the country, and I will give it to them, and you yourself will profit from this decision. Let me do it. We're going to learn why he wanted to give exactly this amount of money. He had a specific concept in mind. Let's learn verses 10 and 11. The king removed his signet. Notice, where's the last place we saw the king removing his signet ring and giving it to someone to give authority? Wasn't that Pharaoh and Joseph? And didn't we learn out that part of this whole problem stems back to the sale of Yosef? And now the king is giving off his signet ring to say you can go destroy the descendants of Yosef. Who was not involved in the sale of Yosef? Only Shevet Binyamin properly. They had nothing to do with it, which is why it was from Shevet Binyamin's side, Mordechai and Esther, they were the ones to be the redeemers. They were completely clear of the sin of Mechiras Yosef. They had nothing to do ancestrally with the sale of Yosef. Klal Yisrael did. So it's a lot of loose ends coming here. The sale of Yosef, bowing down to the idol in Nebuchadnezzar's time, the attendance of the feasts. There's a lot of things which we're going to knock on the head all in one go here. The king removed his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hamadossa, all the way back to Agag, right? Who's Agag? That's back to Shaul, who let Agag live that one night when his job was to ruin and destroy Amalek, enemy of the Jews. Historically an enemy of the Jews. I'm giving over power to the enemies of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, you know what? Keep the money. It's a beautiful token of appreciation that you're giving me this. It's a very nice idea. Keep your money. Do with them as you please. You know what? They bother me as it is. And now that you've so convinced me in verse 8 by saying that all the five good issue I would have with not destroying the Jews politically and socially and fiscally and environmentally have been nullified, have them. They're just a problem. You're doing me a favour. Haman, you're doing me a favour. Oy vey. Now, it's very unusual for a seller of an item to give a pledge or money to the buyer. It's really, really weird. But that's what's going on here. So that's why the Rabbonim of the Gemara in Megillah, Daf Yudalad Amadala 14a, say that really Ahasuerus was in this very one pasuk, showing what an unimaginable anti-Semite he was. So the famous analogy is that Ahasuerus was like a man with a big mound of dirt, which was a bother, and Haman was a man with a big pit, which was a bother on his property. So Haman said, you know what? You give me the mound, I'll buy the mound from you for 10,000 talents of silver. It fills my problem. I got a problem. And Ahasuerus was like, you know what? Take it. It doesn't matter. You know, they hate each other themselves. They just dislike Klal Yisrael so much. So the actual sale that was to have taken place as offered by Haman didn't ever actually transpire. It was offered, but it was rejected out of kindness. And it didn't happen because Haman wanted to buy Israel, but the king gave him Israel as a gift. If that's the case, now we got a problem. If that's the case, look at 7:4, chapter 7, verse 4. Esther, when she finally reveals her identity to Ahasuerus and says, it's terrible what you're doing. What's the problem? For me and my people have been sold. That's what she said, right? That they've been sold. Well, I've got news for you. They've not been sold. They've been given away as a gift. That's what should have been said. That's a problem, no? Esther, so what's going on? Once the silver was legally procured by the king, Haman was entitled to the equivalent. So the king said to Haman, now the silver is mine, and I formally acquired it. It was a real sale. I accept the sale, but now I'm returning the money to you as a gift. I can only give a gift if I've formally acquired something. I can't give you a gift from my neighbour's property. I can't go into my neighbour's garden, steal something, and give it to you as a gift. It's not mine. Only if I own something outright can I give it to you as a gift. That means what actually happened here. Ahasuerus accepted the money. That's important. Then he said, you know what? Here's the check. 10,000, sir. Have it right back. I've got it. I've taken a Kenyan. That's it. It's mine. Have it back. I want to give you this as a gift, Haman. I want to give it to you. That's what it means. The silver is given to you and the people do with as you please. Look at verse 11. Hakesev nosun loch. How can I give you the silver unless it's mine to give? The sale really happened. The sale happened, but he was so enamored with Haman's plan. He said, you know what? I'm feeling in a good mood. Have the whole lot back. So when Esther says in 7:4, my people were sold, she's quite right. The fact then you gave it all the money as a gift back is neither here nor there. A sale occurred. What is going on? What's this? What is going on with this sale? What's going on with this money? What's going on with the silver? Why not gold? Why not gold for such an amount? Why silver? You need a lot more silver for 10,000 tat. It's more economical to pay a large amount of money in 50s than it is in 10s. £50 is the largest denomination of bill in the UK. Five is the smallest. Pay it in £5 notes. That's crazy. If I'm going to pay $1 million to someone, I'd want to use $100 bills, not $1 bills. This is key. This is absolutely key. It's a worth coming moment. It's a worth coming moment. I know you had to give out of your evening. This is now a worth coming moment. What's going on with this thousands of talents of silver? What on earth is happening? 10,000 talents of silver. It's a lot of money. Ahasuerus went to all this trouble of effecting a fully formal sale and then handing over all of that silver back to Haman as a gift, rather than telling Haman from the outset, "Ach, keep it. Don't even give me the silver. There's no price. There's no price. Just do what you want. It doesn't cost you a penny." Why do you say, "No, you're right. I'll take the money. I'll legally acquire it. And then I want to give it to you as a gift." What is going on here? Had Ahasuerus said that really you don't have to worry about the silver and you can keep the money, that means the king would despise them and didn't consider the Jews a worthy asset. Actually, Ahasuerus wanted to show his appreciation to Haman for offering to expel them from his kingdom. What's going on? The king formally acquired the silver to demonstrate that he considered the Jewish people of very great value. They are an important, because legally, remember the whole thing with the building of the base of Migdash, and it didn't happen, and he threw a party because that means God has given over jurisdiction to him. Having the Jews under his remit is a very choshev azach, very important thing. The Jews are now mine. That means I've got remit over the whole world. Why did Nebuchadnezzar want all the Jews to bow to an idol? See, he could force the Jews to serve him in perpetuity. And he wanted that because the Jews are choshev. And if I get the Jews under my thumb, I've got the world under my thumb. Whoever owns Klal Yisrael owns the world. They're the major players. I very much value them. 10,000 talents of silver, that's the cost. I'll take the money. But then I want to give it you back. Why? Because Haman would have felt that the king was actually giving him a true gift of 10,000 pieces of silver if he's acquired it. And he wants to make Haman happy. Why does King Ahasuerus want to make Haman happy? Now listen to this. This is key. This is what I'll say. He loved Haman. Why? What was the most important thing Haman had done for him? Haman had been instrumental in finding him, the king, the love of his life, Esther. He, Poshet, was infatuated with Esther. And he almost is only too happy to have lost Vashti, who he loved. And remember, he had that picture in his bedroom, a portrait of Vashti, which he took off and he replaced it with Esther. He's head over heels in love with this woman. And if it wasn't for the clever counsel of Haman that got Vashti out of the way, and it was all the other advisors that said, "What are you, crazy? This isn't a reason to get rid of Vashti." And only one man, Memuchan, Haman, was saying, "Get rid of her." So that was for his own reason, because he wanted her out of the way because Vashti didn't agree with Haman, and Haman wanted to power play. Ahasuerus didn't know that. He thought, Vashti was rebellious. And this clever man has got rid of a big thorn in my side, Vashti. Remember, he had to have the party in the garden. Vashti took the palace because she's really royal. And who's he? A nochschlepper, you know, a horse boy, a squire. Got rid of that problem and gave him the most beautiful, wonderful woman he's ever met, who he can't stop thinking about. If it wasn't for Haman, he wouldn't be so happy. So he wanted to do a personal favor. I want to give you the gift that pays for your tremendous service to the crown of giving Esther. Little did he know, and little did Haman know, getting Esther into that position is what's going to end up killing Haman. The whole scene has been set only to get Esther in the position to get rid of Haman. Mamish, unbelievable. But why 10,000 talents of silver? Okay, now we realize why it's got to be a formal sale and a genuine gift. But why that actual price tag? Where'd you come up with that figure from? There's a Gemara in Megillah of Daf Tes Zayin Amud Aleph. And there's a Tosfos there. And it says like this: after the exodus from Egypt, when all the Jewish people were in the desert, each male Jew between the ages of 20 and 70, not just 60, the ages of 20 and 70, had to give an annual donation of a half shekel, silver shekel, for holy use to the temple treasury. Now, the first ones that were given were actually melted down. And famously, those melted down silver bits made the Adonim. It made the silver sockets, which if you have a look here, the two prongs of the Kerashim, which are the two prongs that come out the bottom of the bars, which made the main structure of the Mishkan, slotted into two silver sockets. These were the Adanim. And you had two sockets per tenon, right? That was the first. Now, that was to atone for the sin of the golden calf. But from there on in, every year, you still had to give machtzis a shekel. You have to give that for temple upkeep, to keep the place together, to buy korbonos that were for communal funds. And of course, it was a redemption value for everybody. It worked as an atonement. That half coin worked as an atonement. Since there were 600,000 Jews at the time, Haman made a calculation. There's 600,000 Jews giving a half shekel, or 2,550 Jews, giving a half shekel every year for 39 or 40 years while they were in the desert. He wanted to adjust for inflation. That's the Yalkut Shemoni, adjusting for inflation, to cover it for at least 50 years. The 10,000 talents cover 50 years worth of half shekel donations of the Jews in the desert to make sure he's absolutely covered any possible atonement that was gained by that half shekel per person per year. That is an amazing thing to think about. That completely undoes all their atonement of all their donations for half a century. And that will for sure cover, with inflation, the 39/40 years of payments that were made in the Midbar. Think about how much Torah knowledge you have to have when you're doing that. He has to understand Jewish history. He has to know why the people were giving the shekel. He has to believe it worked. Rabbi, he has to accept that it works and that God does exist and he will accept that as an atonement and that will stand the Jewish people in good stead. And he has to financially deal with that problem. Otherwise, his plan's not going to go through because his evil needs to undo the good the Jews have done. Why is he thinking like that? Isn't that mega frum? How frum is that? That's key for any successful plan against the Jews. The truth is, God does exist. The truth is, God does have a special relationship with us. The truth is, God has said in the Torah, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, there are certain things the Jews have done to earn merit with him. And he knows if you want to destroy this people of God, you better undo the merit they've got with God. So let's physically pay for it. I personally want the schus of paying for all that money. I want to undo all their merit. In silver. Why not gold? Because they gave a half shekel in silver. I too will pay in silver. Undoing all of that without question. I'll overpay. I'll pay through the nose. I'll inflate the price. 100% I've got to undo all those silver coins. Because I know those silver coins count for something. I believe it. It's very interesting. Maybe that's why the Nuremberg Trial, they say Purim Fest. You've got to know a lot of Torah to understand about Purim. And they have to understand they're the Amalekites. You have to be holding on a much higher level than just a secular hatred of Jews to understand what's going on here. So Achashverosh also intended, along with Haman, as a plan, through the sale of the silver, which is another reason he accepted the sale. He understood this. And he wanted to accept the sale because remember, it was him that was miscounting 70 years about the Beis Hamikdash not being rebuilt. He's also into these countings to annul the atonement of the Jews afforded by the donation to the Machtzis HaShekel in the desert. So they used the identical amount of the silver to make sure they themselves have true power over the Jews. So you see, at the top echelon of real hard anti-Semitism, there's quite a lot of spiritual endeavor as well that has to go into things. Absolutely incredible. They had to believe the Torah for this. Otherwise, why would they waste all that money? Verse 12. The king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month. And it was written according to everything that Haman commanded to the king's officials. So basically, Ahasuerus has given Haman full jurisdiction, full administrative power to tell the scribes how to go about this. He's not getting involved now. I'm giving it over to you. Himmler, you're in charge. You get this job done. Whatever you need, I'll bankroll it. But it's on you. You organize the propaganda. Okay? And that went to the governors of every province and to all the ministers of every people. Keywords now. Each province in its own script, each people in its own language. 10 points to anyone who can say where we've seen that before. Where did we see before? Each province, its own script, each people, its own language. The answer is, what happens if you go back to verse, chapter 1, verse 22? Look at chapter 1, verse 22. What happened when Haman thought it'd be very clever to send letters out to everyone to say that men should be bosses in their own home? Remember that? How stupid that was, and what a farce he made of himself. Look at verse 22. In chapter 1, he sent letters to all the provinces of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, to each people in its own language. Now, isn't that interesting? When that happened, that means everyone started to disdain these letters, thinking they're nothing but idiocy coming from the, you know, from the crown. Silly letters saying, you know, you should, you know, play Sudoku on Thursday. It's like, for goodness sake, do you know what I mean? Like, I should be a boss in my own home. Which means when they got the letters, they took it with a pinch of salt anyway. That's already been seeded by Memuchan's wicked advice regarding Vashti earlier on. It was written in the name of the king, in the Reich. It was stamped that it had the authority of the Reich. And Ahasuerus, the king Ahasuerus, and he sealed it with the king's signet ring, which gives it absolute authority. This is very interesting. Again, all very spiritually potent. It was not Haman who went to call the scribes, but notice it's the king's messengers. The pasuk is very clear. The king's scribes were called, and that Haman commanded the king's officials. Haman and Ahasuerus wanted to finalize the matter immediately. When it came to dictating the actual text, that was done according to everything Haman had commanded, not Ahasuerus. And that includes now the instruction of Lahashmid, total annihilation, not just ruin of the Jews, absolute, complete destruction. The date of the destruction was the 13th of Adar. And why was that specific? The Gemara Yud Gimel Amud Beis, that's Gemara Megillah 13b, says, why did he choose Adar? Now, we already said this earlier, with Eliyahu going upstairs running around in a panic, and he bumped into Moshe Rabbeinu and said, you've got to get this sorted out. That's because Adar is the month where we lost Moshe Rabbeinu. And he realizes that once Moshe Rabbeinu is an ultimate schus for Klal Yisrael, he knew that. See, even the biggest Rosha, the biggest Nazi, still has to grudgingly admit in the merit of Moshe Rabbeinu. Isn't that interesting? You have to say, Moshe, he's choshev. So let's look into it. Let's see when we can get rid of him. Adar, that's got to be the month. But remember, Moshe Rabbeinu died on Zayin Adar. He died on the 7th of Adar, not the 13th. Now, he was aware that during the 7 days of mourning, from the 7th to the 14th, of the passing of a tzaddik, the world still benefits from his merit. Where do we learn this out? It's in Bereishis. In Bereishis, in Parshas Noach, in chapter 7, verse 10, it says, Mesushalach, who was a great tzaddik, he was the most long-lived person anywhere in Torah Novim because of him, He died at the ripe old age of 969 years old. And Hashem offset the beginning of the flood a week to have covered for him for the Shiva. Because during the Shiva, the covered of a tzaddik is still in the world and the merit of that tzaddik still envelops the world. So Hashem said, you know what? I'm going to postpone the reign of the Mabul to not come until after the end of Meshulach's Shiva. Haman knew that. It's amazing how much Tyre this Russia knew, right? In deference to the honor of a tzaddik, you got to wait for the Shiva. So during the 7 days of mourning for Meshulach's passing, Hashem illuminated the whole world with a special spiritual light called the Or HaGonos, which he's going to hide away after that, only for the Tzaddikim. He doesn't want the Rishonim to benefit from that, but for that week, he allowed the world to enjoy it in the merit of Meshulach, even though he's passed. So that's why he knew, he died on Zion, but at the end of the Shiva, his power truly wanes. We're going to set it for the 13th. It's unbelievably spiritually aware to make these calculations. Now, obviously, if you believe in God and you believe that he chose Klal Yisrael, that he destroyed Egypt for this people, do you really think you as one man can just pay a large amount of money and upset the world status of the Jews and God himself? Yeah, because he's a Russia. That's what Rishonim do. That's what they're like. So Haman delayed his evil schemes against the Jews until the completion of the 7 days of mourning for Moshe. And in that way, Haman planned that the merit of Moshe couldn't protect Klal Yisrael, because they're going to be getting up from the Shiva on the 13th. See, he felt like this. Moshe passed away on the 7th, and the day of passing is counted as the first of the 7 days. And that'll therefore be concluded at the 13th, not the 14th. Very frum, no? Again, he seems to know the halacha. Since on the final day, there's always a rule that a part of the day is considered the complete day, and he's aware of the halacha from the Gemara Sanhedrin 108b, he didn't wait until the 14th of Adar and say, I'll wait until the completion. Because no, al pi halacha, 13 is like 14 in this case. They'll be getting up on the 13th. Let's not wait a moment. Such zrizus. We also see Bilam got up very early to saddle his donkey to go and curse Klal Yisrael. Ooh, don't waste a moment. Have I got an opportunity to kill Klal Yisrael? Let's get straight to it. I won't wait till the end of the day. Amazing. Absolutely amazing, no? The king's scribes were called on the 13th of Nisan and no earlier. Because during the first 12 days of Nisan, what's the problem now? Parshas Nasai. He knew the Torah. What happened in Parshas Nasai? The clan heads, the princes of each clan or tribe, the clans, all gave their inauguration offerings at that time. Each clan's representative came along and the Torah lists them out all individually to Socha Shivas. Instead of saying all of them just gave exactly the same korban, which they did, it lists everyone as an individual treasure. He gave this one, he gave that one, he gave, and it's all the same. And that's what makes it the largest parsha in the entire Torah, 176 verses. You could have cut that down by loads. It was saying each person gave this korban and this is what it consisted of. No, each one was a protectorate. So what did he do? Those 12 clan heads cover the first 12 days of the month. So he had to wait. He had to wait because that's also a merit. He knew that was a tremendous merit in Parshas Nasai. They inaugurated the Mishkan with that. And therefore, with those sacrifices, those offerings that were brought to God, with those golden bowls and ladles and everything that they gave, each leader has his designated day. And thus it was possible that Haman called the scribes on the 13th in order to prevent the merit of those Tzaddikim from protecting Klal Yisrael as well. He's got worry. He's got the worry of Moshe Rabbeinu, and he's got the worry of the clan heads. What's he worried about, essentially? Tzaddikim. Rishoyim's major enemy are Tzaddikim. Just like in this story, Haman's major enemy was Mordechai. whenever you're a Rosha and you want to destroy Tzaddikim, you've got to work with what you're working with. So real Roshoyim have to take into account the actions of real Tzaddikim as they really know what they're up against. This is not some idiot in the street who just hates Jews and hates Israel or something like that. They're just, you know, down with Zionism. This is an individual who's got a cold, calculated plan to uproot Knesset Yisrael from the world. Now, he knows you want to do that. You're going to have to uproot their tzidkus because they're tzaddikim. I've got to have a plan. And it's got to be well thought out. Numerology has to be brought into this. Zodiac has to be brought into this. Certain times in Jewish history where tzaddikim did great things have to be brought into this. And I have to pick my time just right where I know that they're specifically weak. And when their weakness is not being shielded by the merit of their righteous, that's when I will strike. How he knew all that, and it didn't occur to him that God would step up to defend his own beloved people, is an enigma. But that's the way of Roshayim. They're blinded by their hatred. They just can't figure it out. So too with Bilam, and to a certain extent, I can say even with Korach. How could Korach make a revolt against Moshe Rabbeinu after, because he was blinded by his own ego as to what he wanted to achieve personally? He couldn't see the wood for the trees, as it were. Please God, what we'll do next time is we've only got just a few pesukim left, just a couple of pesukim left. Three pesukim, actually. We'll finish this and we'll see that how this edict goes into play. And then we'll see the next steps as to how the story unfolds, which is truly fascinating. But at least know that we're dealing with a very learned, very savvy Rosha who understands Jewish merit possibly more than many Jews do, and knows that if you really want to enact any kind of actual dent to Klal Yisrael, you've got to play according to the Torah's rules, which he did. Which is why, by the way, he was such a threat. He's a real threat because he's really doing this. A bunch of idiots outside just screaming down with Israel. It's very uncomfortable, very unpleasant. It's not a genuine threat to the extancy of Klal Yisrael. But if you want to actually have a dent on Klal Yisrael and you say, look, we've got to look into the Torah and see where they're weak in the Torah, now you've got a problem. Now you've got a problem. And he knew that. And he's playing the game. He's playing the game. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu has literally stumped him every single move that he's making. Every day that he picks, everything that he's doing is actually only for his downfall, as we will learn. An unbelievable turnabout is happening. But it should scare us that we're with a real player over here. He's a real problem because he's looking into our tradition. And please God, we'll see how this pans out. We've just got a couple of pesukim left here. And we'll see how this works out and then see how the whole system progresses, especially with Esther and Mordechai, how they're going to respond to this. And what King Ahasuerus can and can't do now that he's used his signet ring to wax stamp, to wax seal this decree. It can't be undone. When Ahasuerus does finally realize, my gosh, what a mistake that I've made. I never realized what's going on. We've got a new problem. In fact, they said, what can I do? I've issued a royal decree. How, you know, Mordechai and his cleverness, you have to be able to figure this out because I can't rescind this. We'll see how it all pans out. It's fascinating. Thank you very, very much for taking out your time for being here. I really